welcome back to We the People. This is hour two. We're here on Sunday, June 30th, 2019, just in case we replay this at another time. You'll have references for anything we might say that's in current events. And yeah, we won't even go there because there's too much in current events and it's all really bizarre. So we're going to talk about factual things today with our guest, Myron Magnet. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And we do not have a public sponsor at the moment, but we do have lots of nice folks who contribute to the show, and we really appreciate pitching in. You can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. We always post things about our guests, all the previous shows. I've tried to start clustering shows of the same topic at the top of the page. So we have shows about veterans, all the different shows we've done on marijuana at the top. What else did I put up there? Oh, sure. Now I've got to do this. Oh, South Africa. I forgot about that. We've got like 10 different shows on the issues in South Africa. And so that is all kind of gathered for you at the top of the page there. So if you are looking for another topic we haven't done, or you're curious about something and you think we might want to cover it, please send it our direction. You can find that all at wethepeopleradio.us. You've got our emails and our phone numbers for Bill and I.
There you go. Yeah,
moving forward. All right, our guest, Myron Magnet, is a prize-winning author and journalist. He's the editor-at-large of City Journal and author of the new book, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. He previously served as editor of City Journal and a member of the board of editors of Fortune magazine. He is one of America's leading public intellectuals and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal in 2008. He is a frequent media guest who has appeared on major radio, well, obviously, now he's on our show, so major radio, and television programs nationwide. He's written extensively for some of our nation's leading publications, such as the Wall Street Journal, National Review, Commentary, The American Spectator, and the New York Times.
We the People Radio.
And we the People Radio. Yeah. His work has covered a wide range of topics from American society and social policy to history, economics, literature, and the American founding. He previously authored The Founders at Home, The Dream and the Nightmare, and several other titles. He has a bachelor's degree from Columbia and the University of Cambridge. Well, how much fun is that? Okay, so now we've exhausted the entirety of our information about our guest, and we're off into the topic at this point. Myron?
How are you, Aaron and Bill?
Well, doing
we
fantastic.
Are super. And, gosh, what a timely, I mean, I know we set this up with Stephen quite a while back, and little did we know it would be right after the crazy train left two nights of debates at our station. Good Lord. It's like, please, yes, let's talk about the Constitution.
Well, yeah, I mean, to get back to something that we're rooted in.
Factual?
Well, let's hope it's factual. I mean, to the
well, I know men can't have babies, so we're not going to talk about that.
Oh, really?
Well, you're discriminating against me.
And we are going to play that Monty Python clip one of these days. God, if you haven't seen it, yes. I want to be a woman. Good Lord.
Oh, yes. Well, let me tell you about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution.
Yes, this is awesome.
It's close to my heart. I wrote it because you mentioned that I had a previous book which was called The Founders at Home, and I'm a journalist, so when I have a big question that I want to get answered, I write a book about it, so the research answers the question. And in The Founders at Home, what I wanted to know is, what kind of republic did the Founding Fathers imagine, and what kind of government did they frame in writing the Constitution? So, okay, I answered those questions, but I was left with two other really big ones, which were, well, we don't have that government anymore. So what happened to
it? What went wrong?
Is there some way to get it back? And that's what led me to Clarence Thomas, because it's been 28 years now since he's been on the court, and he has written hundreds upon hundreds of opinions, and in those opinions he eloquently sets out history by which the court subverted that original Constitution. you know, Scalia, who you know how everybody used to say that Justice Thomas was kind of Scalia's ventriloquist dummy, but Scalia said, you know, compared to Thomas, I am a faint-hearted originalist. Thomas is the real thing, and what he takes to be the original Constitution is that document which the framers wrote in 1787 as improved by the Bill of Rights a couple of years later, perfected by the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War and the 19th Amendment giving women the vote. And what he would say is 232 years after the Constitutional Convention, this remains the most up-to-date, cutting-edge, avant-garde idea of government that anybody has ever dreamed up, because this is a government that doesn't set out to rule you. It's a government whose only function is to protect the individual citizen's right to pursue his own happiness in his own way, in his family, in his local community. Well, that's pretty terrific stuff. And if you read it, I mean, to me, his greatest decision is one called McDonald v. Chicago. And it's really heartbreaking to read the history that he sets forth in there, which is, by the way, something I knew nothing about, and this sent me off on a whole study of Reconstruction, which I never imagined I'd be doing. But he says, I mean, in effect, here's what happened. The founding fathers understood perfectly well that slavery was inconsistent with their principles. Even Thomas Jefferson, slaveholder that all our politically correct schools teach kids that he was,
right.
Even he, or especially he, knew that slavery was inconsistent with the idea that he penned in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed with unalienable rights. But the founders could not get rid of slavery if they wanted to get the Constitution ratified.
Mm-hmm.
So they did everything, and you know, and it's Lincoln who makes this point most forcefully. If you read his speeches starting in 1854, this is the theme that he harps on and harps on, and that especially in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he's passionate about this. You know, so what did they try to do? They tried to limit it in the Northwest Ordinance. They tried to limit it by cutting off the slave trade in 1808, and they thought that it would simply collapse of its own economic inefficiency, as it was already starting to do at the time of the Constitutional Convention. But guess what? Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin. Slavery moves south, you know, to the deep south, and expands. And so we end up fighting a civil war to make the founder's dream finally come true. All right. Nearly 400,000 Union soldiers die to make men free. And the Congress, which is now, you understand, just Northerners right after the Civil War, passes those great 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And the very heart of those Reconstruction Amendments is the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, whose purpose is to clothe freed slaves in all the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights against state governments. In other words, to protect the lives, liberties, and properties of freed slaves against any incursions by the state governments. Now, along comes the Supreme Court in two 1870s decisions. And the whole country is sitting on the edge of its seat, wondering what is the how is the Supreme Court going to interpret this 14th Amendment? And the Supreme Court in 1873 and 1876 comes up with these two utterly bizarre opinions, and reading them over and reading the dissents, which are furious, it's just hard to know even what they had in mind. But essentially what they said is, oh, those rights contained in the Bill of Rights? No, that's not what the 14th Amendment gives to freed slaves. The rights that are protected are rights like the right to travel on interstate waterways, or not to be subject to bills of attainder. And anyway, the Constitution doesn't confer those rights. It just says that Congress can't invade them. So the upshot is that the Supreme Court basically nullifies the Civil War. And the result is 90 plus years of Jim Crow in the South. And Justice Thomas says, hey, this is personal with me. He said, I grew up in Savannah under segregation, and I know what government oppression is like. So it's very, very painful to him that his own court made this horrendous mistake.
Myron. There's no good time to break this, but we've got to take a quick
please go ahead.
Little celebration of capitalism here for 2 minutes, and we'll be right back. To talk more about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, back to Clarence Thomas.
I was saying, Aaron, that in looking at these awful, really monstrous decisions of the 1870s that overturned the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause, Clarence Thomas began to develop, or really had developed, what is the centerpiece of his jurisprudence. He says, when we Supreme Court justices look at laws that the Congress has passed and the President has signed, and we think they are unconstitutional, we don't hesitate to overturn them. And he said, well, it's our duty to keep looking back at our own decisions, both we personally and our predecessors, and just keep tormenting ourselves with asking, were we right? Were we right? Were we right? And if we find that we or our esteemed predecessors were in error, we got to say so, and we have to overturn those decisions. Now, this is what makes Clarence Thomas a flaming radical in judicial terms. One of the holy of holy rubrics of judging is the doctrine of stare decisis, that judges must respect precedent. And Thomas says, the only sare decisis for a Supreme Court justice is the Constitution itself, the written words as understood by the framers and the ratifiers. And that's it. And beyond that, everything that the law schools teach as constitutional law is really just a bunch of opinions by very smart judges, of course, but they may or may not be correct. And he goes on to say that there are two other large acts in the subversion of the Constitution that the court needs to reexamine and to set right where it went wrong. One of them stars Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, and it was Wilson, our first professor president, who thought he knew which way the arc of history bent much better than your ordinary American voter. He hated the Founding Fathers. He hated the Constitution. And he laid down this theory in which he said, you know, we've got to have a Darwinian Constitution that adapts to the times, that adjusts, that evolves, because everything is changing so fast in modernity. So we need the Supreme Court sitting as a kind of permanent constitutional convention making up laws. And above all, we need this army of Ivy League-trained bureaucrats in either independent or executive branch agencies like the FTC or the SEC, who will make rules like a legislature, carry them out like an executive, and adjudicate and punish infractions of them like a judiciary, all without any separation of powers or basis in the Constitution whatsoever. Franklin Roosevelt supersizes this, and it's not that the Supreme Court did this, but the Supreme Court, with Franklin Roosevelt's gun to its head, validated this usurpation of power. And so suddenly now we have all these bureaucrats swarming over the country and ruling us. And Thomas looks at all of this. He says, this structure has no comfortable home in our constitutional structure. And one of the, you know, the sort of definitive case in which the New Deal court allowed this administrative state to go hog wild was a case called Wickard v. Filburn, which said that the federal government had the right to tell a farmer that he couldn't grow grain to feed to his own livestock. Well, Thomas takes a case that concerns California. So this is, you know, this is in your backyard. And Thomas's case is called Gonzales v. Raich, and it concerns two sick Californians who grow pot and smoke it to control their chronic pain, protected, they think, by California's medical marijuana law. And Thomas says, excuse me, you know, so the feds come and take away their plants, arrest them, charge them with violating the Federal Controlled Substances Act. Thomas strenuously objects and says, this stuff never was bought or sold, never went from one state to another, wasn't commerce, wasn't economic activity. If we allow the federal government to regulate this, they're going to be regulating potluck suppers, right? So, and he names Wickard v. Filbert, and he's saying, this kind of jurisprudence has got to stop. You can't abuse the interstate commerce power of Article I of the Constitution to take control of all human activity in the United States, right? This is a decision that needs to be overturned. And, of course, the third great movement in that subversion is the Warren Court just inventing rights out of whole cloth, rights for gangbangers, rights for students to misbehave in school, rights for people to have welfare as a property right, and so on. And all this needs to be overturned, in his opinion. And you know, you as students of this stuff will remember that only 5 years ago, constitutional experts like Mark Levin or Richard Epstein were saying we need to have a new constitutional convention as envisioned by Article 5 of the Constitution in order to roll back these excrescences that courts have slopped all over the Constitution. Well, we don't really need to do that anymore because, although, yes, we have certainly had some misfires in the last 2 weeks, we got a Supreme Court that is moving right, that does not hesitate now to overturn precedents that it considers to be ill-advised and mistaken. And we might actually be able to get our old Constitution back. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is that when Woodrow Wilson was putting forth his theory of the administrative state, he was thinking this was super modern, right? Darwinian. It wasn't like these old fuddy-duddies in wigs at the Constitutional Convention. But his model was the Prussian monarch Frederick the Great with his incorruptible civil service. So it's like he's saying what's modern is enlightened despotism instead of democratic self-government. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That can't possibly be, don't you think?
Well, just the fact that the court has to support precedent is saying the court never makes a mistake.
And Justice Thomas wrote a really, really interesting opinion just last Monday, a week ago tomorrow. And he said, you know what? The unwritten British Constitution evolves by judicial opinion. It governed the colonists for 150 years before the Constitutional Convention, but they rejected that. They didn't want that kind of a constitution. But he says, even the British jurists, like Blackstone, for instance, the British judge who wrote the law book that was the textbook for the American Founding Fathers, even Blackstone understood that judges, being human, could make mistakes. So even in the tradition where you really do have a constitution that evolves by judicial decree, even there they recognized that judges could make mistakes, and they were willing to reverse previous opinions that they thought to be erroneous. So what is the problem in America? Why shouldn't we reverse decisions that we believe are incorrect, too, such as this one of Wickard v. Filburn, such as these two monstrous 1870s decisions? And, you know, you really want to light the hair on fire of the left, and such as Roe v. Wade, which was wrongly decided, says Justice Thomas.
And you know, the thing is, it's interesting because the pro-life agenda is getting a lot of traction, actually, just because of the left, and it always happens the same way. They always overreach. They overreach and try to assert things that are just patently either false or crazy or both, and when that happens, all of a sudden people start looking at the truth, as you just mentioned, and then, uh-oh. It's all over, but the unraveling. We have to celebrate capitalism one more time here.
Oh, super.
and then we'll be right back with our guest, Myron Magnet. He is the author of a book called Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. We'll be right back.
It's our time to take a stand. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
There's a call. Across this land, remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
We were a city on a hill, a candle in the dark. It started long ago. Now we have
paid a price to be free. Remember who we are. With our blood, sweat, and tears. Remember who we are. Will our children be the ones asking us one day why we didn't?
Discussing the Lost Constitution, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. What a great title.
And what a sad reality, right? That we lost it. And you know, Aaron, one of the points I make in the book is that now at the heart of the bitterness of American politics is... And I mean, you know, we're so angry at each other that we could scarcely speak about politics. And I'm speaking to you from New York. Let me tell you what it's like here.
You know? And we're here in California, so we're having a hate fest out here too.
I get it. And I think that we're having a kind of crisis of legitimacy right now. There's a real disagreement about where the authority of government comes from. So guys like us can be said to be the Freedom Party, right? We believe in the Constitution, in the original Constitution, that guarantees liberty and expects self-reliance. But on the other side, there's what you can call the Fairness Party, and they believe in Woodrow Wilson's living constitution, that's his phrase, that evolved, right? They believe in the administrative state, which the living constitution validated. They believe in making up rules by judges. And what they would say is that in its care for workers, the disadvantaged, the weak, minorities, this represents true democracy in its inclusiveness, even though it so happens that it isn't self-government whatsoever, because everything is being done by unelected judges and unelected bureaucrats. We've given up Republican self-government in this form of government. So I think that we can hardly talk to each other. And, you know, the rage, when people on the left think that settled law, by which they mean Roe v. Wade, might be overturned, it's kind of like, you know, you intend to tear down the statues of all our national heroes, let's say, as if Roe v. Wade has the venerable authority of the Constitution itself. It doesn't. It rests on that previous decision of Griswold v. Connecticut, in which Justice Douglas said the right of privacy comes from emanations formed by penumbras of the Bill of Rights, meaning out of gas and shadows. That's where the right to abortion rests. It's the most amazing thing.
Well, how do you overturn? You know, we talked about the 1870s rulings, and those rulings are still being used as precedent in current cases. I don't know how much anymore, but
very much.
Yeah. So how do you reverse that Roe v. Wade? How does that get reversed? Does it
Well, you can do it incrementally. So Justice Thomas has an opinion called in a case called Stenberg v. Carhart. Now, Stenberg v. Carhart is a case concerning what's euphemistically called partial birth abortion. And what Justice Thomas says is, you know, nobody ever describes what we're talking about here, because to describe it is to condemn it. So he says, let me describe a partial birth abortion. I'm not going to do this on the air. But he describes it.
But we should. We give them these happy little names, you know. Partial birth abortion, it sounds like no big deal.
Okay, well,
but it's killing a person.
It is killing. I mean, it's killing a baby. I mean, and Justice Thomas quotes a nurse who assists, you know, used to assist at these until she just couldn't stand it anymore, and it's just murder. You know, I mean, when she describes it, it's just plain murder. You know, and in effect, says Justice Thomas, you end up with, you know, with just a kind of pile of parts on a tray, like a fryer chicken in the supermarket. I mean, and he said, you know, this is not civilized. This is infanticide. Surely, no civilized community can tolerate something like this. Well, the original Roe v. Wade, I went back and read it to write this book, and you know, even Roe v. Wade, Justice Brennan says, well, you know, there is some point at which the state has an interest in protecting the life of the baby, you know, he states it as being after the second trimester. Now, you know, but it was clear even in Roe v. Wade that there was a line to be drawn somewhere, and you could conceivably argue over where the line was to be drawn. Well, by the time you get to Stenberg v. Carhart, there is no line. I mean, basically, you know, the next question is, well, can you kill your one-year-old?
Right.
You know, can you kill your two-year-old? So, I mean, Bill, to answer your question of how you reverse it, I think that that you do it in stages, as Thomas was trying to do in Stenberg. Try to say, please, this is, you know, this is many bridges too far. We really can't have infanticide, so you can do it incrementally. But I also think that there have been so many, you know, so many state laws passed now, either banning or reining in abortion, that this issue is going to come before the Supreme Court in the very near future. And I think what's going to happen is that the Supreme Court is just going to stand up and say, you know what? I mean, look, if it gets the choice of saying we're drawing the line at, let's say, viability, which is where most civilized communities used to draw the line, you know, then you can be sure that Chief Justice Roberts will go for that, and that's where we'll end up. But, you know, I mean, we could also end up with 4.5 conservatives on the court saying Roe v. Wade was improperly decided, and we overturn it, and we send all this back to the states where it belongs. The federal government, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. You know, there's certainly no, and it's not a question of there not being a right to abortion. The Constitution is a document of limited and enumerated powers. It is not interested in getting into people's bedrooms. The Constitution is about things like interstate commerce and the power to levy taxes and make treaties, right? It's not about the intimate life of individuals. So the federal government doesn't belong in this area whatsoever. So I can imagine a court in the very near future saying, sorry, you know, the federal government has nothing to say about abortion. We hereby overturn Roe v. Wade, and we throw it back to the states and let them decide. And remember, you know, when Roe v. Wade came down, 20-some states had already legalized abortion or liberalized existing legal abortion laws. So we're not going to have a situation in which you can't get an abortion in this country. This is not a Catholic country. What will happen is that there will be a little reason, a little humanity injected into this question, so that we won't be killing babies, which we've been doing for years now.
Yes, and then we call it health care.
We call it women's reproductive rights.
You're exactly right. I mean, language counts. It's ridiculous. I mean, they slide that sort of thing over into, I know we're supposed to take a break, but that's this tiny rant. It's burdening me. In California, they say that all illegal aliens need health care. So we're going to now pay for their health care. It's like, no, we're not. We're paying for health insurance. We are not paying for their health care. We're paying for health insurance.
You're paying for their health care right now.
But, right? I mean...
You're paying for their health care because they're turning up in the emergency
and they're going to the ER. You're exactly right. It's so frustrating.
I mean, it's absolutely insane, you know. I mean, it's absolutely insane. We have uninsured Americans, right?
Right.
But illegals turn up in the emergency rooms and
well, the great part is the uninsured Americans in California are going to get to pay for the health insurance of illegal aliens. So can't wait for that shoe to drop. I have a feeling that'll be a major comeuppance on the folks that usually think this stuff is so magic. Free will not be free anymore. All right, back to capitalism. You've got to salute capitalism here one more time.
I stand up for it.
We'll be right back with our guest, Myron Magnet. You're listening to We the People.
Stand me now, if sometimes I seem to be mad. But don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be mad. Understood. The dream is still alive. Someday it will come true. And this country, it belongs to folks like me and you. So let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country.
All right, Myron, what did we leave out since we have 10 minutes left?
Well, we left out Justice Thomas. Let me put in a word for Justice Thomas, because his life is something extraordinary, and he draws some very important conclusions from it. He didn't quite go from log cabin to White House, but he did go from a kerosene-lit shanty in a Georgia swamp to the high bench. And you know his story. By now divorced mother took him and his little brother to a Savannah slum when he was about 7. Couldn't keep him for more than a year, during which time he said he knew hunger and cold like it would never end. And then she sent him a few blocks away to her father and stepmother. And her father was this extraordinary man, Thomas's grandfather, a self-made man, semi-literate, but he'd started a coal and ice delivery business, which had become a fuel oil delivery business by the time the boys came to live with him. And he had converted to Catholicism because he wanted an orderly religion. And he brought up the boys in the most structured way, he sent them to parochial school, segregated, but the nuns taught them that all men were created equal and that, therefore, segregation was wrong. And the grandfather put the boys to work in the oil delivery business after school and on weekends from the time they were in third grade. And in the summers, there were 60 acres of kind of scrubby land down in South Georgia that nobody in the family wanted. So he took the boys down, and the three of them built with their own hands a cinder block house and cleared the land and plowed it up. And every summer they'd go there and till the fields and plant the crops and raise the animals and butcher a few of them for winter food. And they lived a pioneer-like existence. And all the time the grandfather was urging them on with these, you know, I can hear my own parents, right? Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he learned self-reliance by relying on himself. And although he was going to be a Catholic priest, but he dropped out of seminary when he saw some racism there that he could not square with what he thought the Catholic mission was. He went to Holy Cross, where he went through a black radical phase. He ended up in a demonstration in Cambridge, Mass., which turned into a riot, I mean, in which cops got hurt and property got damaged and burned. And he came back to Holy Cross, and in the morning he went into the chapel and prayed to God to relieve him from his anger against racism, and asked himself, did he really believe in America? Did he really believe in Jefferson's promise? And he decided that, yeah, he really did, and he was gonna give this up. And he returned to those precepts of his grandfather's, which, although his grandfather was a lifelong Democrat and a very active member of the NAACP, that really is conservatism. And he says, you know, to be self-reliant in that way. He said, when we were kids, we read all those kid biographies of heroes, George Washington, Marie Curie, George Washington Carver, and the idea was here were people who overcame adversity to make their own fates in their own life, and went even further than that and changed the world for the better for everybody. So we learned that you're not just the plaything of vast forces, but you're an independent actor who can actually arrange the world for yourself. Because nowadays, we've got all this emphasis on victims who, they're not responsible for their fate. Large forces made them what they are, and only a mighty government can intervene to protect them against racism, inequality, you name it. And the lesson that he draws from this contrast is a powerful one and very important for all Americans to reflect upon, which is that it takes a special, particular kind of individual and national character to be capable of liberty. You can't have a free republic of self-governing citizens without individuals who are self-reliant and self-governing themselves. Well, in order to have that, you need to have a culture that nurtures characters like this. And if you have a campus culture where everybody is going to safe spaces to be protected from these microaggressions because they belong to micro-victim groups, you're not going to have the kind of sturdy, pioneer-type citizens that can keep a country free. I'm listening to your theme song, and I'm thinking, man, I like this song, and Clarence Thomas would like it, too.
Oh, good.
You can't be a whiny victim and at the same time a free citizen. And it's the job of the culture to have strong families that build strong characters that are the citizens of a strong republic. And this is not right this minute the prevailing orthodoxy, but I think it's what every conservative believes, and what every conservative is trying to do in his own family with his own kids, and it is worthy of the deepest reflection that we've got to do. You know, Thomas says in a speech at one point, he says, you know what, we tend to think that everything is done with the laws. You know, because we're judges. He says, it's not. He says, and he puts his hand on his heart. He says, it's done in here. It's done in here. It's done because we believe certain things, right? We hold certain truths to be self-evident, right? They're deep, deep beliefs. And if we lose those beliefs, then we're kind of losing the culture that underpins that original constitution that guarantees our liberty.
Do you think in the 3 minutes we have left,
no pressure too.
Yeah, no pressure. That Clarence Thomas's opinions are going to have an impact on the rest of the sitting court?
Oh, yes. And you know, even 10 years ago, he was looked at as this kook out there in right field. But now, the smart liberal law professors like Akhil Amar, for instance, are starting to understand that this is a very profoundly serious jurist, and who has laid out a comprehensive blueprint for how to restore our original constitution of liberty. And here is a very important fact. He's been on the court, as I say, for 28 years now, and he's had a lot of clerks in that time. And he and his wife treat the clerks like they're their children. You know, they foster them, mentor them, stay in touch with them ever after, promote their careers. And 20% of the judges whom the Trump administration has elevated to the federal bench are former Clarence Thomas clerks. 20%.
Oh, wow.
So Justice Thomas has laid out this roadmap for how to get back to the Constitution of Liberty, and he's put the troops in place who could carry that out. And I can name you a couple of people who could a couple of ex-Clarence Thomas clerks who would make very fine Supreme Court justices sometime in future. As I say, you know, we were in such despair even 5 years ago that Mark Levin was saying we got to have a new constitutional.
Oh, and it is just looking up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Myron, hit the wall here. We've hit the wall. Leonard Skinner's given us the signing off music.
Yeah. What a great conversation. I really appreciate
We really want to have
on.
You come back, and I'd love to hear about your other book as well, The Founders at Home.
I'm happy to be California Dreaming with you.
Nice. Our hostage this hour has been the great Myron Magnet, author of Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, and we're going to make him come back with us because we like him.
Thank you so much.